From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Unaffordable childcare, inflexible workplaces, policies that don't support families, it all weighs on parents. And the numbers bear that out. American parents are much unhappier than adults without children. The gap is the largest among 22 countries. We love those kids, but this hour on Point, why American parents are so unhappy and what to do about it. You can join us on air or online. Do you look with envy at countries that provide free or deeply discounted daycare, parental leave, and more accommodations? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll make a sharp turn and look at the heartache, hope, and struggle of infertility. But first, joining me from Austin, Texas, is Jennifer Glass, professor of sociology at the Population Center at the University of Texas at Austin. She is co-author of the new paper, Parenthood and Happiness, Effects of Work-Family Reconciliation Policies in 22 Countries. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Jennifer Glass, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we tend to believe that children bring great joy to families, and they do. But what did you set out to study?
Well, we know from about 30 years of research that surprisingly, parents report less happiness and greater depressive symptomatology and anxiety than non-parents in the United States. And what my co-authors and I were curious about is whether this finding holds up in countries that are similar to the United States but have a different policy regime for families. And our suspicion was that some of the unhappiness relative to non-parents in the U.S. is caused by a particularly harsh policy context for parents, particularly parents of young children and for employed parents and single parents who need supports in order to be able to meet their caregiving responsibilities and also to bring home the bacon and support their families.
So how much unhappier are American parents than non-parents?
Well, it seems curious to talk about happiness in percentage terms, but we allowed people to place themselves on a happiness ladder of 10 points. And what we found is that American parents are about 12 percentage points lower than non-parents. And that's the biggest gap that we see across the 22 nations that we studied.
Right, because Americans ranked second out of 22 countries in terms of happiness generally, but last in terms of the happiness gap between parents and non-parents?
Yes, exactly. So I don't want anybody to think that Americans writ large are just unhappy people. That's definitely not true. We don't know how much of the country-level happiness differences are cultural, however, because we think that in the U.S., people are particularly prone to say that they're happy because of our individualistic culture. So people sometimes think, oh, if I'm not happy, it's my own fault. Whereas in other countries, it's better not to stand out too much. It's better not to be extreme in any of your emotions. And so they tend not to scale themselves on the 8, 9, 10 of our 10-point ladder, and they tend to, as a country, rate themselves more in the middle of the scale. So we're not quite sure what that means, if people are really happier in the U.S. than other places, or we're just more prone to say that we're happy. So we just look within countries and look at the gap within each country between parents and non-parents.
So to your study, it's not that we don't love our kids, we do. It's the negative effects of parenthood on happiness were entirely explained by the absence of these social policies that allow parents to combine work and family obligations. Is that the bottom line?
Correct. When we added at the country level what kind of policy regime individuals lived in, we found that it totally explained the variation in this gap. So the countries that have good policy regimes tended to have no gap or had parents that were happier than non-parents. But in countries that scored very low on these public policies that support employed parents, we found that the gap starts to increase the worse the policy context.
And this is true for mothers and fathers. Is that right?
Yes, yes, surprisingly. So there are small differences in what affects mothers most and what affects fathers most. But overall, there were similar responses to similar policies.
In what countries are parents happier than non-parents?
It's an interesting set of countries. It includes some Soviet-era nations. So Russia is in there. Hungary is in there. But we also see France, Finland, Sweden, Norway, and Spain and Portugal in that group. So these are all countries in which there was either no difference or parents were actually happier than non-parents.
You write that subsidized childcare and paid leave are especially important for families. Seems obvious, but tell us more about that.
We tested a whole range of policies, and we actually weren't sure which ones were going to be most important. So it was a little bit surprising to us that those two popped out. On reflection, it shouldn't have been as surprising. So if you think about things like paid parenting leave, which is very, very popular, and we see lots of legislative action on that, it really only affects parents in the first year or so of life. So it's great when you have a baby, but unfortunately, children stay at home for 18 plus years. And so there's still ages 2 through 18 plus that you have to worry about. So I think for that reason, it was paid sick and vacation time that ended up being tremendously important to parents, because that's something that continues throughout that life stage when you have dependent children at home. The cost of childcare was surprising because, again, that's a cost that only occurs before children are school-aged. But much to our surprise, it was the cost as a percentage of the average wage in that country for your average two-year-old that came out as a very, very strong predictor of this happiness gap. And we think that that's because it's a proxy for a whole set of attitudes about children's education and children's care starting from birth onward. So these are communities that have decided to invest heavily in that early childhood development era. They believe that making sure that all children have great early child care is important. And what was most shocking to us is that these two policies, the paid sick and vacation leave and the subsidized child care, benefited non-parents, that non-parents who lived in countries that had these policies were actually happier. So it's not a zero-sum game where you do things that are important for parents and you somehow make non-parents more unhappy, right, or more miserable.
The policies for parents were not achieved at the expense of people who don't have kids.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And of course, for paid sick and vacation leave, that makes sense. Everybody needs paid sick and vacation leave. The child care one is still somewhat of a mystery to us. And again, we think it's because it says something about the quality of life in countries that pay a great deal of attention to children's growth and development. So if you think about it, we know that if you invest heavily in quality early childhood experiences, that you're going to have kids that do better in school. That means that they're going to stay in school longer, they're going to exhibit less delinquent behavior, they're going to be in better health. And all of this means that everyone's life is going to be better when those children become adults.
So you talk about subsidized child care, paid leave. What about work flexibility as part of family policy packages? Do American parents work longer hours than their European counterparts? How does that play in?
Yes, they do work longer hours. And we thought that work flexibility would have a strong impact. So we looked at countries that had right to ask laws where you could alter your work schedule or reduce your work hours if you had dependent children. And it surprisingly did not have much impact. And I think that's because many of the institutions that structure children's time aren't so flexible. So child care centers, for example, are not so flexible. And we think that work flexibility in the American context in particular is something that sometimes comes as a cost. So you might get some flexibility options for your employer, but you're supposed to feel grateful for that, and you're supposed to work harder. And indeed, we show in other work that I've done that people who telecommute end up putting in longer hours for their employer.
Oh, that's interesting. Here's Jessica Shortall. She's an advocate for more generous paid leave. At her TEDx talk at Southern Methodist University in October of 2015, she told stories of mothers she'd heard from who had tough reentries to work. We pulled one such story. Here it is.
I was an active duty service member at a federal prison. I returned to work after the maximum allowed 8 weeks for my C-section. A male coworker was annoyed that I had been out on vacation, so he intentionally opened the door on me while I was pumping breast milk and stood in the doorway with inmates in the hallway.
Must have heard stories like that, Jennifer Glass.
Yeah, absolutely. We do a very poor job of reintegrating mothers into the labor force. And this is particularly the case with these very, very short leaves. So even in the legislative packages that we have in some states like California, it's still only 12 weeks. Meanwhile, we have the American Pediatric Association and the AMA telling mothers that they should exclusively breastfeed for at least 6 months. And anybody who's gone through that experience knows that it's very difficult to find the privacy and to find the relaxation to actually pump milk at work. And then you have to store the milk, and then you have to get it home, and you have to make sure it's not spoiled. Mm-hmm. It's just a major hassle. And most of the rest of the industrialized world and all of the countries that have no parental happiness gap are countries in which mothers are entitled to a 6-month, at least partially paid, mostly fully paid leave. Mm.
What were some of the other barriers to parental happiness in the United States?
The biggest ones, as I said, were those two big policies. But we also did what we called a policy scale, where we combined work flexibility, paid parenting leave, and ordinary paid sick and vacation days. And the power of that scale was monumental. So we believe that you can't just take one policy and say, oh, this is the cure-all for everything. We really believe that this is a policy package, that if you can combine a relatively short, say, 6-month paid parenting leave with subsidized child care, with ongoing paid sick and vacation days, and the ability to take a sick day when you have a dependent child who's ill, that package is what's most effective at keeping parents happy. Right now, we live in what I call the culture of gratitude. Everything is individualistic. It's doled out one at a time, and you're supposed to feel very grateful to your employer if they give you any kind of a break for undertaking this massively important job of parenting the next generation. And I can illustrate with a quick story from a study that I did in the 1990s. This was a young woman who was pregnant, still living at home. Her boyfriend had fled, was out of the picture, and she worked full-time as a dental assistant in the front office of a dentist. She was on public assistance, and so she had to use public health services, and the public health clinic closed at 5 o'clock every day. And she didn't get out of work until 5 o'clock every day. So she didn't know how she was going to make it to her prenatal care appointments, and asked her employer, and he reluctantly agreed to let her leave at 4:30 once a month for her prenatal care appointments, but only if she came in an extra half hour early. And she was profoundly grateful for this slight schedule modification. And it just made my heart sink to think of an employer that was so stingy that he wouldn't allow this woman even a half hour to go to a prenatal care appointment without forcing her to work that half hour at some other point in time.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're looking at why American parents are unhappier than adults without children and why that happiness gap is the largest among 22 countries. You can join the conversation. Parents, what weighs on you most about raising a child in the United States? When grandma doesn't live next door anymore, or even if she does and needs to be working herself, how does that change your work-family balance? From the trailer of the film Bad Moms, which comes out July 28th, you'll hear here Mila Kunis as a mother being stretched way too thin.
Emergency PTA meeting today at 5 o'clock. Will we see you there?
I'll totally get a sitter on a Tuesday night.
Yes, you can.
No problem.
You actually can.
What do I have on the schedule today?
You're super late for your marketing meeting.
You have to tell me these things!
I can't believe I'm going to be late for my first soccer practice.
I'm sorry, okay? I'm trying.
Well, try harder, dude.
A lot of comments on this hour. Listener Patrick says, I'm not an unhappy parent, just really tired. It's a long day and can be a challenge to find the mental and physical energy to enter into my kids' world, aged 1 and 3, and really connect with them. But the joy that comes from watching your kids develop and seeing the world open for them is like nothing else. The only way to experience that joy is by spending time with them. And my wife and I make conscious lifestyle choices to make sure that we spend as much time with our kids as we can, and our family is happier for it. John says, I'm happy to pay to educate other people's children. I'm grateful that the state educated me and believe it is society's responsibility to do so, but the middle class should pay for its own daycare. With me this hour, Jennifer Glass, professor of sociology at the Population Center at the University of Texas at Austin. She is co-author of the new paper, Parenthood and Happiness, Effects of Work-Family Reconciliation Policies in 22 Countries. Jennifer, talk about the finances, how the economic strain plays into this. U.S. government statistics estimate that a middle-income family can spend about $235,000 to raise a child born, I guess it was those statistics from 2011, but to raise them to age of 17, that's a lot of money. Does it cost more to raise kids in the U.S. than in other countries around the world?
Absolutely. And that figure, of course, does not include the cost of college tuition and living expenses, which also are generally brought on by or are paid for by parents rather than the state. And even if you look at state universities like my own, you can see that the amount that parents are being asked to pay and students themselves is going up and up and up, and the amount that the state is contributing is going down and down and down. So state universities are feeling this pinch very tightly. They're forced to raise tuition because the state simply isn't subsidizing college at the rate that it did 20, 30, and 40 years ago. So we know that a lot of other institutions are pulling away from the support of children. We know that public education in this country has been very controversial. There have been enormous tax cuts here in Texas. No longer do we see funding for public schools that are as generous as they have been in the past. We see lots of school districts in which many, many schools show poor academic achievement among children. A lot of that has to do with divestment and flight of taxpayers to low-tax suburbs where they don't have to pay for the cost of educating other people's children.
A lot of calls here. Jennifer Glass, let's go to Angela in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Angela. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to echo a few points from your first guest and say that even in my situation where I could take up to 6 weeks off with some pay, I found that when I talked about coming back to work, thinking about wanting to breastfeed for about 6 months, I was told that I was going to have to reapply for my position, which was shocking to me, but it, you know, forced me to come back to work much earlier. And when I got pregnant a second time and I was trying to work out a part-time position, what I found was that my company was willing for me to continue with the same workload, but pay me part-time for missing meetings and things like that. So it felt like I was really thankful that I still had my job, but I was getting paid less for doing as much, if not more, because I had to, you know, prep for my classes with a newborn baby. And that just felt like a cheat, a way for the company to keep me and my talent, but also not compensate me for that. And I left my job to find another more family-friendly situation. And those do exist, but I think it's always at the discretion of the employer.
Angela, thank you. Jennifer Glass, Angela describes the culture of gratitude that you described earlier quite well. Yeah,
exactly. And in other countries, this just isn't an issue. All employers know what the rules are, and no companies are allowed to benefit by cheating their employees of certain rights. And so as long as you have that floor below which no business can fall, you don't have this sense among employers that, oh, if I give these generous benefits, I'm going to be at a disadvantage relative to my competitors.
Here's Jay in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Jay. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
And your guest, Jennifer. I wanted to know if it plays into it, the dependent tax deduction. We're in an election, and you talk about some of the economic stresses, but I haven't heard any candidate say, here, raise the dependent tax deduction for kids to a higher point. And certainly I understand some of the argument of other people saying, why of single people saying or childless people saying, why should I subsidize someone else? But why isn't there any talk of the dependent tax deduction, raising that and then letting parents, because it is far more expensive? You know,
Jay, thank you. I appreciate your call. Jennifer Glass, the current tax exemption, was it $4,000 a child? Is that right?
Right. Someone did an economic analysis several years ago and found that if the dependent tax deduction had risen at the same rate as inflation since the 1950s, since the Eisenhower era, it would be worth about $16,000 per child, which is way, that's literally four times as high as it is right now. And that's, remember, for a single child. So most people have two children. So if you think about it, you have to kind of double all of those figures to see what that exemption should be worth if you're really trying to discount the costs of children. But it's not, and it doesn't look like it's going to be raised that high anytime in the future. But there's another important point that needs to be made, and that's that any kind of tax deduction relies on parents making enough money so that they pay into the tax system to begin with. So a deduction doesn't do you much good if you're a single parent who's working at a big box store at minimum wage. You simply are stretched to the max. There's no way that you're making enough money that a bigger deduction would would impact you. So for those folks, it's the earned income tax credit. But again, I think the larger point is, why do we see this as such a huge issue for parents? In part, it's because so many other institutions have been backing away from supporting children. So the idea that communities, the idea that neighborhoods, the idea that schools are there to assist parents has really kind of evaporated over time. But it's even worse than that, because what we see is an abandonment within the family. So fathers are less likely to be present in their children's lives. And so mothers are now carrying more of both the caregiving burden and the financial support of children. We know that about 40% of American children have their mother as their primary breadwinner. So I just want that to sink in. Over 40% of American children rely on their mothers to provide most of the income for their families. So that's certainly not been the case until the last 20 or 30 years. So everybody's been kind of abandoning the costs of raising children, and that's escalated the burden on parents and particularly mothers.
Let's go to Mark in Urbana, Ohio. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi. A couple things. First of all, the so-called gap between the happiness of childless and child parents, maybe it's because in America, childless people are, maybe they're just happier on a scale of 1 to 10. Maybe there are a lot of opportunities here in America for childless couples who they're just happy. Secondly, as a childless couple, we have wonderful, loving relationships with our nieces and nephews. We love children, but having a child is it's a major life decision, which I think people take much too lightly. It's a major financial decision, a lifetime of challenges, and, of course, love, but financial responsibility. So why should childless couples bear more financial burden to support a choice that other people have made?
All right, Mark. Thank you very much. Jennifer Glass, fair point. How do you respond?
I hear that a lot. The pure fact of the matter is that we are an economy. The United States is an economy. And the strength of that economy relies on our ability to reproduce that economy. So I frequently have heard from my students, for example, well, I'm not planning on having children, and I'm just going to save all of that money so that I can have a nice retirement and I can just buy all of the services that maybe my adult children would have provided for me in old age. And I point out that that's not going to work in a situation of falling fertility. When everybody decides that they're going to be happier if they don't have kids, then fewer people have children. And then it becomes very, very difficult to find workers in 20 years. Who's going to be the doctor that cares for you in your old age? Who are the workers going to be that keep your economy strong so that all those dollars that you've saved are actually worth something when you decide to retire? So we all need healthy, well-raised children in order for our economy to flourish. And the genius, MacArthur genius economist Nancy Fulbray put this very well in a number of books and articles that she's written. And she says, children are not pets. Your dog is not going to pay into your Social Security when it gets older. But those children, those pesky children that all of your neighbors have, they are. Mm-hmm. They are going to be the foundation of the economy that keeps the United States strong. And so you need to care for everyone's children. They will be the labor force of the future, and everyone will need them.
You write in this report that fertility rates are going down in the U.S. Immigrant communities are keeping birth rates higher, but white Americans are not keeping up, much like we've seen in Europe, to your point. I want to play this sound. Pamela Druckerman, as author of many popular books, including Bringing Up Bebe, she talks about French parenting. Here she is on Fox News in 2013, talking about some of her findings.
In some ways, French parenting resembles what American parenting was like when I grew up in the 70s and 80s.
Okay.
It's a little bit old school. Its life does not revolve entirely around the kids, and that's better for the kids. That's the overarching principle.
Jennifer Glass, talk about that. Is the American approach to parenting part of the problem here? Are we sacrificing too much, including our happiness, for our children?
Well, I think that she's on to something. I think that there is what we like to call competitive parenting in the United States. But a lot of that is brought on by the kind of competitive labor market that we have. So the reason that parents feel such intense pressures to spend on their children, to monitor their children, to put their children in organized activities, is that we've kind of ratcheted up the competition for the few good jobs that remain for college graduates. And so the idea is that if you don't start young, your child won't get into the right grade school, and then they won't get into the right high school, and then they won't get into the right college, and then they won't get the right internships and the right connections to secure them a middle-class position in the labor market. So we're in this age of anxiety, this tremendous anxiety about whether our children will be able to do as well as we did, and that's what fuels a lot of this competitive parenting. But I would hasten to add that this is really a middle-class and upper-middle-class phenomenon. This is not something that most parents even have the luxury to consider. Right. So this is a very classed notion of what, quote-unquote, American parenting is like.
A lot of calls here. Let's get Eve in Uniontown, Ohio. Hi, Eve. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I was a nanny for 30 years, and I also work in a psych-related field. I'm from two different cultures, one of them being Amish Mennonite. And I've seen and experienced anxiety and stress in single parenting as well due to divorce. I believe we're unhappier as parents due to a change in mindset rather than a problem with work benefit. I believe to some extent we've been fed the feminist lie that we can have it all at the same time without sacrificing anything in exchange. We believe as a culture that we're largely entitled to help from the state in raising our kids rather than being personally responsible for the consequences of poor choices and realizing it's actually a privilege to have kids and our ultimate responsibility to raise them. I believe family breakdown, as you said, contributes to this. It's our choice and it's a trade-off. And being happy while having children is a choice.
Eve, thank you so much. Jennifer Glass, a change in mindset. There are trade-offs. There are certain seasons in life, motherhood and fatherhood being one of them. What do you say?
Well, I think what the caller is saying is that essentially you can't expect to be successful and have children. And I think that you can't really build a healthy economy and a healthy society if that's your initial premise. And many, many of these countries that have instituted social policies that impact families find that they have robust fertility rates, they have thriving economies, and they have a happier citizenry. So this idea is kind of nihilistic that, well, you can't expect to be successful and happy and still have children. Reflects a worldview that simply isn't true of the past. In the past, we had many, many more extended families and community members who were involved in the raising of children. It was a community effort. So this idea that somehow in the mythic past we had rugged individualists who raised kids and somehow found the money to do so despite a competitive labor market that won't hire them, I think that's a nostalgic myth about a past that never existed.
Jennifer is in Rocky Hill, Connecticut. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Well, I was surprised to hear your caller or your guest say that the cost of childcare ends when children are of school age. I have two children, and that hasn't been the case for me at all. There's before school care and after school care. If you work full time, there's no way that your children don't need some kind of care other than you during the school day or after the school day.
Jennifer, thanks. Jennifer?
Oh, excellent point. You're completely right. I mean, my children both had to have after-school care. There was, you know, no way that I was going to be able to get off work at 3 o'clock every day. And then on Thursdays, they had early release at 1 o'clock, so which many school districts do now.
Elizabeth is in Owensboro, Kentucky. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, just accolades to your point. Recently, I was laid off in my position. While I was pregnant, I had to take another job. And this new job, I had to sign a waiver that I would not be supported for FMLA. And I had the baby very, very early. I had HELLP syndrome. 25% of women die from this particular syndrome. Mm. And my baby was due in June, and I had her in April. And anyhow, I had to return to work with a preemie. She wasn't even near her due date when I had to go back to work. And as you know, a preemie cannot go into daycare because
right.
of just being high risk.
Right.
And it was one of the most difficult situations. I was on unpaid maternity. I have worked for 15 years. My husband farms. We don't have insurance. And everyone is very dependent on me to provide.
What a difficult time for your family. I hear it, Elizabeth. I'm glad that you called. So many people struggle with this. Jennifer Glass.
Yes.
I've got about 15 seconds here to wrap up. You are a parent, as you mentioned. I'm curious how you viewed this study through the lens of your own experience.
Well, I'm like everybody else, right? I love my children to death. I think it's the best thing that ever happened to me. But when I sit back and I'm honest about it, I realize that parenthood is like a giant roller coaster ride. Before you have kids, your life is kind of flat. And after you have children, the highs are incredibly high, but the lows are incredibly low. And anyone who has had a sick child or had a child with a disability or a child that was subject to violence knows exactly what I'm talking about. And that never ends. So I just think we live in a culture that makes it difficult for parents to deal with the downsides.
Jennifer Glass, professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. She's co-author of the new paper, Parenthood and Happiness, Effects of Work-Family Reconciliation. Really appreciate this interesting insight that you have and brought us today. Thanks, Jennifer, so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
After this break, one woman's heart-wrenching memoir of infertility. That's coming up after this break. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from finance's role in addressing climate change to the implications of central bank policy decisions, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Millions of women around the world struggle with infertility, and every one of them has a story to tell about the lengths to which they went to try to become mothers. The rounds of IVF, hormone shots, egg retrieval, the enormous expenses, the hopes, tears, joy, sorrow. Writer Julia Lee describes her own journey as an avalanche in a richly raw memoir. She joins us in a moment. We want to hear from you. Is this your story, too? How far will you go? Have you gone to try to have a biological child? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Sydney, Australia, is Julia Lee, author of the new memoir, Avalanche, A Love Story. For an excerpt, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org. Julia, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Hi there. Great to be here.
You've been called one of the greatest living writers. Quite a compliment. This book is beautifully written. It's an intensely personal story about a very common experience that we don't talk about very often. I want you to start by describing the yearning, the desire to have a biological child.
Yes, it's good that we talk about that because I know some people might not understand why I put myself through what I did or why people enter the world of IVF. I would say that, I had a desire to have a child, which, I confess came quite late in life. I was sort of 38 when I first went with my then husband to the clinic. I had a desire to de-center, to no longer be responsible solely for myself, to be intimately involved in the care of another. And the thing is, this desire for the child to be was very strong, and I always knew that the child to be was never a real child. It was unreal, but at the same time, this unknown, unconceived, really was a strong inner presence. I sort of had a radical faith in this child to be, so I did become very attached.
You talk about your first trip to the IVF clinic being one that was full of hope. Tell us what it's like to go through the treatments, the nightly injections, the blood tests, the surgeries, the fact that it really takes over your life.
Yes, it does. And I think it's really worth mentioning that it does take over your life, and there really is a toll. There's a high physical and emotional toll as well as a financial toll. Perhaps I should just talk about what the basic process is for people who might not be familiar with it.
Sure.
So essentially, when you go into, let's say, the idea is to unnaturally stimulate your body to produce a high number of eggs. And so to do that, you go in. You have your bloods tested on day two of your period. You see if you have okay hormone levels ready to go. And then I would inject myself with an artificial hormone that had been produced in a line of recombinant DNA produced in a line of Chinese hamster ovary cells. It sounds incredibly sci-fi, but it really is happening here and now. And I would inject myself each night for, let's say, about 2 weeks. You're monitored as well daily, blood tests. This is a very simple way of saying it. And so you're trying to produce as many eggs as possible. So you feel very uncomfortable, bloated. I mean, there are many other physical side effects as well. The eggs are all there. Then once you get close to ovulating, you take a second needle each night, which sort of keeps all those eggs in place. Then you're scheduled for your surgery. And it's very precisely sort of timed. And you have the last needle you have is a sort of, it's called a trigger shot, which is to essentially press the trigger and release the eggs. The surgery, I had my surgery, it was under a general anesthetic. And that's the eggs are collected.
And how many times did you go through all this?
Okay, yeah. So I did, I'll say exactly what I did so anybody who's in this world will know what I'm talking about. I did something called 2 intrauterine inseminations. And then I did, actually froze my eggs. That was my first egg collection. And then none of those frozen eggs succeeded in creating a viable embryo, and then I then did 5 subsequent egg collections, and after each of those collections, I did a transfer of an embryo or two.
You write about this in the book, and you write about the energy that it takes to start each cycle of treatment, and not even being sure what to call what you were going through. You write about this, and I'd love for you to read that part of the book here now.
To read about it, yes. So this is a little section from I've already failed a few cycles. I heard myself referring to my infertility when talking to my sister, a slip of the tongue. I'd never applied the term to myself before. I wasn't infertile. I was trying to get pregnant. To be infertile sounded like something already decided, finalized, irreversible. I had to drag myself back to the nurses. Dread intermingled with hope this time around. I wasn't sure I could withstand another failure. The test of IVF, I came to realize, is to do with both intensity and duration. IVF is durational in the same way a lot of people can sit at a table and stare at a stranger for 10 minutes. But very few can do it for 700-plus hours.
I'm curious what the reaction was to your family to this decision of yours to go through these IVF treatments. At one point, I believe you were artificially inseminated with your sister's husband's sperm. Is that right?
Actually, not quite. But I did. There was a time when I did ask my sister's, said, why don't you use my husband's sperm, which is an incredibly generous offer on her part. And I must say that as children, never in our wildest dreams did we ever think that was a scenario of how, I would fall pregnant.
And so what did your family think about all this? What was their reaction, their response?
Well, what actually happened with my brother-in-law was his father, when he heard about this, after we'd already started the process and he'd done the donation, etc., he was very much against it. And actually, my parents were not very supportive. It's worth mentioning that IVF, it affects not only you, the person doing it, but also your nearest and dearest, and not everybody around you will be supportive. So my parents were not very supportive. They didn't think it was a good idea. But I have two wonderful sisters, and they were very supportive.
I got a lot of calls in here, Julia. Let's get one in from Los Gatos, California. Hi, Pamela. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Hi. I appreciate your time.
Yes.
Julia's made some really important points here about the emotional investment. And in most of the IVF rounds that couples go through, clinics are so focused on the organs, they forget that those organs are attached to human beings who have dreams. And I really think it's important that we spend some time talking about the need to reform how patients and clinics interact with each other. Clinics need to think about this much more holistically. And I think Julia does an amazing job in her book addressing that.
Thank you, Pamela, so much. Julia, what don't we understand about the IVF industry that we should?
Well, I think something that will surprise people is the high failure rate in that world. And just to be more specific, the best available data in the States, which comes from the Centers for Disease Control, it showed that of about 190,000 cycles, that's a lot, in the year 2013, of those cycles, only 54,000 about resulted in a delivery of a live child and child or children. And so that's a failure rate of 72% across all ages. So that's... it's a high failure rate. I mean, most treatment cycles fail. Yeah.
As did yours.
Yes, and mine did, yes. And so, you know, I wouldn't have written my book if I was successful because I feel the media is saturated with these miracle success stories. But while it is very true, and I completely respect, and I'm so happy for women who've... who were lucky, you know, and who, for whom IVF was a blessing. It's just a plain fact that for many, many, many more women, IVF can be a very ruinous path.
Let's get Nancy in here from Hamburg, Iowa. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I went to, through IVF. Well, it must have been about 25 years ago. My son's 25 now, but it took us about 4 years to have him, and we went through IVF time and time again. It was worth it. The pain, the emotional pain was worth it. The last cycle, my husband said this was it. Financially, it's, you know, expensive, and our insurance paid part, but the last time we went through, the hormones weren't right at the end, and rather than scrub the whole IVF, he said, let's do an insemination in the office with my husband, and it took, and I'm truly blessed.
Nancy, thank you for the call. Julia Lee, Nancy brings up the point about finances. It's expensive. You wrote jokingly in the book about the friend who sold her house to, quote, buy her kids. Talk about the cost associated with infertility treatments and this multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that myself about having to sell your house to buy your kids. That's something that somebody said to me that I found a little bit insensitive. but yes, it is. It's a big business. And I guess we have to be aware that my sense is that there is in the industry an uneasy marriage of commerce and medicine. I mean, this is medicine for profit in so many ways. And I think when people go into IVF as well, you're not really sure. You don't really realize what you're getting into. So you're not only offered basic IVF, you can be offered all these sort of what we call additional treatments. And unfortunately, these additional treatments are not really supported by medical evidence. Very often my doctor would suggest something and then she would say, you know, it's up to you. It's up to you whether you want to do it. I was thinking, well, I'm not a doctor, you know. Yeah, so well, and it can be very baffling and bamboozling.
And so to that point, you talk about in the book, you ask the question, where does this stop? Where does this end? How did you know you were at the end of your journey?
Yeah, well, I think that it's extremely hard to give up. And it's extremely hard to know when to give up. I have to say I was not supported by my doctor in the decision, and which is pretty surprising when you think that I was actually 43. I'd done the two IUIs, I'd done six egg collections. My last transfer, I did have something called a biochemical pregnancy, which essentially meant I had a positive pregnancy result on the Friday, but by Monday that result was a negative. And I'd been saying this is going to be my last cycle, you know. And that little tiny positive result did throw a spanner in the works. And my doctor said, well, why don't you give it one more try? And then I was talking to my sister, and she was very frustrated. And she had the courage to tell me, look, Julia, where does this stop? You know, if you'd been in a natural world, you wouldn't have even known about that biochemical pregnancy. You know, she basically said, you know, you have to find another way to be happy. And it was thanks to her support that I then, there wasn't even an exact moment. I can't think of the exact moment, but then I did decide, okay, I'm stopping now.
What, I have about 15 seconds left here, Julia. What do you want young women to know? What do you want young women to know about fertility treatment?
Gosh, good question. I wish I had an answer. I mean, just really be inform yourself as much as possible about the world of IVF and,
Julia Lee.
And my heart goes out to anybody in that world right now.
Julia is the author of Avalanche, A Love Story. She joins me from Sydney, Australia. Julia, thanks for your insight and for your courage to come on and talk about it. I appreciate it.
A pleasure. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.